Good morning. I want you to imagine, what do you eat for breakfast, for those of us who are breakfast eaters? I eat the same thing every morning. The same kind of cereal, with some kind of berries or fruit, floating in a lot of milk. That's the moment when you know I'm a dairy farmer's daughter. Breakfast is my favorite meal of the day. I love the sweetness from the cereal, and the tartness from the berries when that's when we have on hand, and the creaminess of the milk. It's a small delight that I look forward to each morning. In the selections from Genesis 1 that we heard this morning, we heard snippets of the first creation story in the Bible. Although the words creation story might bring to mind existential thoughts and cosmic questions, the snippets that we heard today actually had a lot to do with food. Now, if we were to read the passage in full, we would see that day one, day two, and the first part of day three really speed along. God said, "Let there be light." So then there was light. God saw it was good, named it, end of day. As we say in my family, boom, bam, done. Same for day two, when God separated the water and the sky. But on day three, things really slow down once dry land has been created. The earth puts forth vegetation, the plant seeds seed, the fruit trees fruit. Dr. Ellen Davis, who's an Old Testament professor and scholar, translates verses 11 and 12 like this. "Let the earth sprout out sprouts, plant seeding seed, fruit trees making fruit, each of its own kind, with their seed in them on the earth, and it was so. And the earth brought forth sprouts, and the plant seeding seed, each of its own kind, and trees making fruit with its seed in it, each of its own kind." Her translation kind of draws out something that we maybe miss in our regular readings of a passage that's so familiar. The passage really waxes poetic about vegetation and its fruitfulness, marked literally by its fruit. Yet this fruitfulness is not concerned with productivity or efficiency. It's the act of other beings. God invites the earth to participate in the act of creation, and so it does. The earth brings forth vegetation. The plants bring forth seed. The trees bring forth fruit. The story is not strictly one of God creating things, but one of God creating beings who participate in the world, even collaborating in the creation of the world. The concern for food is taken up again when humans come along later in the passage. In verses 29 and 30, God tells the first humans that every plant seeding seed and every fruit tree with seed in its fruit are for food. And for every other living creature, all green plants are promised for food. The vegetation that is offered to all creatures, human and non-human, is the very vegetation that just a few verses earlier was described as participating in the creation of the world. These vegetables and fruit beings share their lives with other beings. Humans, along with our animal neighbors, share in their lives every time we eat. God cares about all of creation, from the oats and berries in the cereal bowl, the cow who gives the milk, and the human who eats it, seeing all of these beings as good. The story or poem describes humans as part of this created network of life that is characterized by God's care and God's delight. The story of the creation of the world treats food as more than calories or nutritional inputs. And theologian Norman Wirzba describes food as, quoting him here, "God's love made nutritious and delicious, given for the good of each other." As Wirzba says, food didn't have to be delicious, but God made it delicious. In the context of Genesis 1, God's care and delight for creation includes care and delight in food. When we eat, we can participate in this care and delight. Quoting Wurzba again, he writes that to grow food and eat in a way that is mindful of God is to collaborate with God's own primordial sharing of life in the sharing of food with each other. It's to participate in forms of life and frameworks of meaning that have their root and orientation in God's caring ways with creation. End quote. Eating as a primordial sharing of life suggests that we are not only collaborating with God when we care for creation through our eating, but that we are also collaborating with the very beings in creation that are fruitful for our nourishment. In Genesis 1, vegetation not only feeds other beings, it also models a way of being in the world. When we think of Genesis 1 and the human vocation, many of us probably think of questions around the language of subduing the earth and having dominion or ruling over all living creatures, referenced in one of the songs we sang today. These are important concerns, and concerns that much ink has been spilled over, especially in the last 60 years in relation to the environmental crisis. And there's another instruction that God gives to humans: be fruitful and multiply. This isn't the first time this instruction was given in the chapter. Earlier, the same instruction was given to fish and birds in verses 20 and 21. God's blessing and instruction to them is to be fruitful and multiply. The instruction given to humans, fish, and birds also echoes the earlier instruction to fruit trees to make fruit. Vegetation shows us what it looks like to be fruitful. Plants and seeds and fruit and trees model for us a way of being that works for the good of another, sharing our lives as we collaborate with the rest of creation and with God. With vegetables and fruit as our teachers, we can encounter the world not as full of consumers and commodities, but instead full of manifestations of the love, the grace, and the delight of God. By paying attention to food in Genesis 1, what we find is a network of relationships and connections between all of creation. This network of relations extends also to God, but staying within the relations within creation, what it suggests is a deep reliance on one another, and even a shared responsibility to one another. Okay, so I recently came across a Spanish term used to speak about stewardship, corresponsabilidad. There's another term, mayordomos, and upon conferring with Jackie, I understand that both mean the same thing, stewardship. Despite these being synonyms, seeing the word corresponsabilidad sparked my imagination. And I must be clear, this is because of my poor Spanish language skills, which are almost nothing. But it looks like co-responsibility in English. And as thinking in my English brain, this sparked my imagination in thinking about the text we're looking at today, Genesis 1. The idea of co-responsibility evokes the kind of network of relationships that I've been, you know, looking at in Genesis 1, and that I hope that that you're engaging or thinking about or maybe even challenging that I'm drawing out today. The question this prompts is whether co-responsibility in Genesis 1 concerns humans sharing responsibility for the health of creation, or whether this shared responsibility stretches to include how creation shares responsibility for one another and for us. The network of relations that Genesis 1 presents is one where creation is responsible to and for one another. The vegetation shares its life as food. The sun and moon govern the day and night. Humans exercise what Ellen Davis calls a form of mastery among creation. While we have responsibilities as humans, we are not the only ones with responsibilities, nor are we the only ones with knowledge to teach. We share responsibility with the more than human world. It's when we assume all the responsibility and we assume we hold all the power and all the knowledge, and we don't share the load or don't consider that we might need to ask for help and learn from other parts of the community of creation, that we run into trouble. Thinking about Norman, or thinking with, rather, Norman Wurzburg again, he talks about eating as a form of catechesis or of teaching. Eating is a way of learning that we don't hold all of the power, but that we are dependent on other living beings. Quoting him again, in the daily act of eating, people have the opportunity to appreciate and explore their creaturely condition as beings dependent on each other and on God. In the work of food's production and consumption, people have the chance to learn where and who they are by becoming tillers and keepers of God's edible garden. This sermon's theme is, of course, the peace table. Thinking about eating at the peace table suggests that the very food we consume at the table can teach us about walking the way of peace, seeing ourselves as responsible to one another, both human and more than human. Eating at the peace table invites us to consider whether our ways in the world honor this interconnection and co-responsibility. So this applies to all the obvious things, like where our food comes from, the complexities of our modern food system, which is premised on a small portion of the population engaged in the work of providing food for the rest of us, and the challenges and problems that come with that. But it also extends to the less obvious things, the things we do that seem unrelated to food. I'm from Manitoba, and I grew up on a farm about an hour south of Winnipeg. And growing up, we didn't drive into Winnipeg that often, but now, as an adult, I regularly make the drive from Winnipeg to Grunthal, or vice versa, when I'm visiting, or when, you know, I moved here from Winnipeg before making it here to Toronto. The drive is, exactly as you'd expect, a rural one, lots of fields on either side of the highway. And about 15 minutes south of Winnipeg is the community of Ildishane. Recently, the land around Ildishane became a hot topic in Manitoba because of a data center, a massive data center, that was proposed to be built in a field next to the community. The arguments from the public against it are, as you'd expect, based on concerns around noise pollution, light pollution, air pollution, you know, there's others. Thinking about these concerns or about the water usage, thinking about the usage of natural gas that's used to power these massive data centers and their huge energy concerns, those are all important concerns. And when thinking of this situation in conversation with the relations of responsibility between all of creation in Genesis 1, another important concern rises to the surface. AI and the pursuit of artificial general intelligence is premised on a view of land and the more than human world that sees it as objects, not as fellow creatures. So the land that the large-scale data center in Ildishane was to be built on is or was agricultural land. Food was grown there. The company that was trying to build the center, Jet AI, describes their work and the location as follows. This is from their website. Developing the land that powers AI, Jet AI secures and develops shovel-ready data center sites across North America, from raw land to powered campuses. And it goes on. So the land here is described in three ways: needing to be developed as a shovel-ready site, and as potentially transformed from raw land to powered campuses. Land is an object and a commodity. This description of land rings of colonial perceptions of land, such as Locke's theory of homesteading, that saw land as becoming property only once activities like cultivation began. And that kind of logic is here extended, except suggesting that the raw land is properly used not when cultivated, as Locke argued, but when built on to support the development of technology. Brian Burkhart, a Cherokee philosopher, argues that colonial perceptions of land are rooted in seeing land as an object, whereas indigenous perceptions of land are rooted in seeing land as kin. He argues this is not just about seeing humans and land as intertwining, but instead about seeing land as personal, familial, and creative. The framework underlying settler colonialism views land as an object with humans, as he puts it, floating free from the land. As Burkhardt makes clear, this is not only about a view of land, but also a view of people, too. The framework underlying Indigenous relations to land understands the land as a person and, as he puts it, the relational ground of kinship, and views humans as, again, his words here, part of the earth that brings humans forth. So views humans as part of the earth that brings humans forth. So an aside for those of us who are not Indigenous, I'm not proposing we appropriate this way of relating to land and place as our own. I'm speaking as a settler here. Being treaty people includes learning to live here in ways that respect and do not seek to dominate Indigenous peoples. I think, for example, of the two-row wampum between the Haudenosaunee and the Dutch. Respect and non-domination require a reevaluation of colonial views of land. And so Burkhardt and others are teachers and can teach those of us who are settlers to learn another way of understanding ourselves and the land without positioning this knowledge as ours, which would further colonial dispossession and harm. Burkhardt's analysis makes clear that the language describing the field in Ildesheim as shovel-ready, it really only makes sense from a settler colonial perspective of land as an object that humans exist apart from or float free from. Now, I'm currently reading a book called Empire of AI, and in it, the journalist and author Karen Howe argues that the way that the development of AI and AGI are being pursued and the massive economic and political power that AI companies and leaders have amassed in our societies is imperialistic. The leaders of these few companies, the few companies at the top driving things, are forming empires, global empires. Her argument in the book is that it doesn't have to be this way, that this way of developing AI is not inevitable, despite some of the rhetoric around it. And leaving her broader argument aside, I want to share with you a quote that she cites from OpenAI's co-founder. So this is the company that developed ChatGPT. So a quote from the co-founder and former chief scientist, Ilya Sutskever, that speaks to land relations. So Sutskever says, quoting him, "I think that it's fairly likely that it will not take too long of a time for the entire surface of the Earth to be covered with data centers and power stations. There would be a tsunami of computing, almost like a natural phenomenon. AGI, artificial general intelligence, and thus data centers needed to support them, would be too useful to not exist." This quote from one of the men directing the development of AI has a shock factor to it, at least for me. Read alongside Genesis 1, it invites us to consider our own assumptions about humans and land. Who do we think and act as if humans are enmeshed with? Are we more closely enmeshed with machines than the natural world? Is land empty and ready for development? Or is the land full of beings that we share responsibility with and are responsible to? Our answers to these questions aren't only theoretical, but have implications for what role for AI we pursue in our society and what ways we use it or don't in our own lives. Thinking about breakfast again, the central ingredient in my morning granola is oats. That grain is grown on the prairies, could perhaps even be grown in the location of the data center that was shut down by the province of Manitoba. If my breakfast is an opportunity for me to sit at the peace table, the oats invite me to recognize my reliance on them and the network we form together. Our lives grow together, and we're responsible for one another. Together, we are part of the meshwork of creation, called to share our lives together with other creatures and beings in the more than human world, called to share responsibility for one another, and invited to learn at the peace table how to walk in a way that is in partnership with the rest of the created world, the world that God called good.